Welcome to the Flying Solo Podcast. I'm your host, Katie Kangas, and each week on the show, we will talk about how to take flight and follow your dreams as a solopreneur architect. In this episode, I talk with Joy Martin, founder of Joy Architecture and Interior Design, a boutique firm with roots in two cities, a testament to Joy's ability to thrive wherever she lands. Her practice embodies collaboration, attentive service, and genuine support, not only within her team, but with every client relationship she builds. An image of her practice is the European starling. Like a starling, Joy has adapted gracefully to new environments, turning life's biggest changes into opportunities. Starlings are known for their dazzling murmurations. Thousands of individual birds moving together, responding to one another to form evolving shapes in the sky. That same spirit defines Joy's approach to design, fluid, collaborative, and attuned to the rhythm of her team and clients. In this episode, we discuss how her personal resilience is reflected in her team, and it has led to a growing and successful architecture firm. Welcome to the Flying Solo Podcast. I am your host, Katie Kangas, and this podcast is about how to take flight and follow your dreams as a solopreneur architect. Today, I'm talking with Joy Martin, who founded her own firm, Joy Architecture and Interior Design. Is that the correct name?
Yes.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
You rebranded, so I'm trying to remember.
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Great. So today I'm talking with Joy Martin of Joy Architecture and Interior Design. She founded her firm here in Minnesota. And welcome, Joy, to the podcast.
Thank you, Katie, for having me.
So Joy, why don't you tell us a little bit about how you started your firm and how Joy Architecture came to be?
Sure. Well, I started the firm in January of 2016, on January 1st, actually, of 2016. I had been in the architecture industry since I finished undergrad in 1999 from Clemson University and working for various other architects all around North America. And I felt a call to go out on my own when the firm that I was working for was kind of having some difficulties, and I was being asked to moonlight by potential clients. And my response sort of was, well, I'm moonlight as a mom of two toddlers. So there was no room in my schedule to do that. And, you know, it doesn't really feel like the right thing to do. So I struck out on my own. I basically had been thinking about it for many years and taking notes from different places where I worked about things I would do or not do if I owned my own firm. And I, you know, gave my notice and the timing felt right. So I really didn't think a whole lot about overthink the brand or the marketing or anything. I just thought, okay, how much do I need to make? And how many projects will it take to make that much? And okay, I got those leads. Let's just do this. And so I kind of knew what I was doing at that point. I'd been working for about 16 years for other people. And so, you know, I knew lots of good things about architecture by then. So I just took the leap, started a website and went on some, you know, build your own website on house.com and then build my own brand and business card online and printed them up and went into business.
What a great start. And there are some sources, business sources that really complicate that early calculus of like how much money you need to make and how much overhead. And they really make it odd, but you broke it down so nicely that here's my goal for my income.
Yeah.
Here's how many projects and what size those projects need to be.
Yeah.
And that equaled what was coming in. And so it can be that simple.
Yes.
To just exchange your work environment from working for someone else in an office to, hey, working directly with the client. I love that.
For sure. The one thing that I knew going in was that taxes were a big question mark. I didn't know how much I would have to pay in taxes based on my new setup. So I just went really conservative and I had a savings account and a checking account for the business. And I, for every check that came in, I set 30% in that savings account. And that more than covered me because that's way more than one person running a small office would need to have for that first year, but it definitely helped soften the blow when the tax bill came due.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's good to have those margins as you're building up. That's great. I love how you described that you took notes while you were working for other people. Did those notes start to define your firm? Could you describe your firm in 3 words?
Yeah, for sure. So the notes really were, things that I saw. Architects are sort of historically very creative people, and not always creative people aren't always the best at managing people. But a really talented architect can get really far in business and growing their firm and getting, unique projects and hiring people to help execute those projects. But then the management can kind of become really secondary to the creative output of the firm. And so what I saw in my experience was just a lot of sort of missed opportunity with managing the people that were working for these talented architects. And so the notes I would take were sort of like, I would make sure that sort of the men and the women in the same position are being paid the same. That's like a great example because I experienced that firsthand. I would like really not care what time people are coming into the office if it's reasonable and their work is being completed in a timely manner. Like those were the kinds of things. And also like culturally, what kind of mood would I want to set? Would there be music and would there be, activities to do socially together? And so I had all these, kind of fun ideas that were really soft, written down in the back. I would always keep notebooks. And so I'd always write them down in the back of these notebooks that I kept. And so the other thing I saw was like the lack of credit given to the design team among every architecture firm I worked for. No one ever called out the names of the people on the team. And so that translated directly into sort of the words that describe my firm's approach as collaborative, attentive, and supportive. And those all, kind of fall under the umbrella of being creative, obviously, because that's our job as architects is to be creative and solution driven. But I like to translate those collaborative, attentive, and supportive into both the in the workplace and with how we treat our clients and with how we connect with builders. So there's talent all around us and everyone brings different skill set to the table. And so really leaning into each of those parties that play a role throughout the course of a project in a collaborative way really makes for better projects and better outcomes and better experiences for everyone involved. So that collaboration piece is super important. And I think that, being attentive, it's kind of, I would say that's a one word answer for saying like, we are really good listeners. A lot of architects have a style that they'll imprint on a project or on all projects. You go to certain architects for the certain style and you are getting a really, really beautiful version of their style or interpretation of what your home should be and, or your space, whatever it is you're building. So what the people that work for me and myself are trained classically in architecture and design. And so we're able to listen and pivot and shift and apply style to any style to the best solution. So we're really looking at form and function, holding hands together, and then of wrapping it in a style that reflects our clients' lifestyle and needs.
I love that. And so collaborative, attentive, and supportive. What are unique ways that you're supporting your clients?
That one kind of plays out in the attentive side as well. Like, we are working with people because most of our work is major remodels and additions. So we are basically tearing apart the most expensive asset they own and putting it back together. So it is a very stressful process, both because we're, asking them to go live somewhere else while we tear apart their home, and asking them to invest a large amount of money in this endeavor. And so by really being good communicators and kind of listening to the tone of how things are going throughout the project, managing expectations, all of that is part of that supportive role. Like we are a partnership in this process with our clients. And we kind of do that with the builder as well. We try and bring the builder in very early on, make them a part of the team so that the client feels supported, not just by us as the designer sort of driving the process forward, but also by the builder who is going to come at it with a solutions-based approach as well.
And that's a great way. And it's just good practice to be working with your clients that way and serving them that way. It really emphasizes architecture as a service, not as a commodity, not as just this product that you purchase. You're not just buying a home. You're buying this process. And your website does a great job of outlining that in a way that I think people can just quickly get a good glance. I also loved that you offer this early design process for your clients. Can you tell me a little bit about what inspired having this like pre-design study service?
Yeah, I saw a lot of projects go through extensive design process before any kind of real numbers were put to it. You know, clients will often come to us with a budget or think they have a budget, and our job is to tell them like, yes, that's realistic, or you're going to need to double your budget or whatever, or we change your scope of work, you know, to fit your budget. And I think that in the sort of traditional architecture process, it has historically been the architect who gives some advice about budget. The client and architect go on this design journey together, and then you create a bid set of drawings and send it out to a couple of builders who sort of maybe have never seen the project or talk to the clients before then. And at that point, the client has invested a significant amount of money in design time and has a set of drawings that they are falling in love with and want, you know, to build their dream.
So true.
Yeah. And then they meet, you know, the builders and are met with this like harsh reality of how unaffordable the design is. And so by bringing in those builders early and doing that early design feasibility study, we'll do a feasibility study and a schematic design, both, and at both points, we'll kind of look at like, okay, can this scope fit in this budget? Or what do we need to talk about here to manage expectations? And timeline is part of that as well. Yeah. Like, you know, if they expect it to be 6 months because they're having a baby, then it's a year-long project and we really need to have that conversation up front.
And you've been practicing nearly 10 years with your own firm. I've only been going for 5, and that's the only way I've found to survive through just the financial uncertainties.
Oh yeah.
Right now.
Oh yeah.
Things are up and down and changing all the time. And I've got to work with these contractors in a collaborative way.
Yeah.
Or else I'm not giving real information to these clients. And
so
it's
true.
Very frustrating to see things die on the drawing table.
It is. Yes. I always tell clients that it's my goal to design what you can build, not to design something that just gets left behind. Yep.
That's great. Well, what clients do you serve? Are there certain clients or projects that you seek, or an ideal client for your firm and your practice?
Sure. So the types of projects we seek or are most skilled in are primarily single family residential. And we do new build, major renovations and additions. We also do multifamily work that's kind of usually like 30 units and below. You know, so I would call that sort of boutique multifamily. We aren't doing high rises or anything like that. And then boutique commercials. So like we'll do some, you know, tenant improvement type of projects where we're fitting up a new shop, or we've done like a nail salon or a judo, jiu-jitsu dojo, and like, you know, places like that. They're sort of unique and fitting the brand of the client. And those are really fun. So I enjoy all those types of projects, and they're a reflection of the work that my career path has had. The clients that we serve are pretty much all clients. I mean, I think we attract a lot of people who are interested in hiring a woman-owned business. We work with empty nesters. We work with young families. But really, I mean, certainly in the last 5 years, 5 to 7 years, we've had people come and say, like, I am actually, you know, looking at 2 different firms and hiring you because we wanted to work with a woman-owned business, which is a really interesting and really cool, you know, characteristic to be chosen for. So we try and deliver.
That's great. And you use the term boutique a lot on your website, and you just used it now. What does boutique mean to you?
Sure. That means to me a very customized experience, customized for the client and their lifestyle and what, you know, the things that bring them the most joy. So I would say, you know, couture maybe would be sort of little bit too she, but boutique. And it also is a reflection of the size of our firm. So the scale of the projects and the size of our firm and sort of the custom approach to our work.
That's great. And so how do you find these clients, or how do they find you, do you think?
A lot of our work is through word of mouth. Comes to us that way. Yeah, from past clients kind of saying like, you know, use Joy and Allison. They're awesome to work with, which is like the best compliment you can get is to have, you know, a past client refer you. And then we also seek out builders. When I first started out, my philosophy was basically that like you spend a lot of time at work, surround yourself with people you really like. Don't tolerate people who aren't going to be nice to work with. And that includes clients and builders. And so when I started working, I had, you know, like 3 leads. And there were, you know, 2 of them were very small, and 1 of them was a repeat client from the past and who just wanted to work with me individually. And they were a great start for my company to open the doors. And when I knew a few builders that I liked, and I called them up and I was like, I'm starting my thing. Who in town is nice to work with, basically? And they, other builders, you know, I was like, tell me some great carpenters that are nice to work with that won't mind working with a female architect. And so, because not everyone is, you know, comfortable doing that in the construction industry. So I just started taking people out to coffee. You know, I got a short list of builders that sort of fit the bill and started taking people out to coffee and telling them, you know, I'll do this really quick, short, inexpensive, creative design process with your client. And we'll come up with some ideas and you can put a, you know, a number to it, a budget to it, and then we'll try and turn it into a real project. And so that became the way that I built my firm, was taking really, I mean, that we called it the LCC. I called it the LCC. It was a low-cost commitment. You could sign up with me and I'd take a look at your project. I'd sketch out some ideas, put together some inspiration imagery, and we'd talk about it. And then we'd connect with a builder or two and have them put a ballpark estimate to it. And you could walk away at that moment. You know, there was no, anyone can still walk away from a project anytime they want. But like at that point, you had invested, you know, about $1,000 into a project and gotten some like feasible solutions and an idea of how much it would cost and how long it would take and who you might work with. We still do the same thing. And I still meet with builders who I think are going to be interesting to collaborate with and connect with on projects. And, you know, I probably once a month, I'll go out to coffee with a builder that I think would be a good fit for me and my clients.
That's a good reminder to always be nurturing those leads. They're not necessarily leads. It's just a way of networking. It's a way of reaching out and staying relevant and continuing to build a base network, even in the busy seasons, before you're even looking for work, that you're always reaching out and reminding people who you are and checking back in with them.
For sure. I think it's nice too, to kind of just get you out of your head a little bit. You know, the grind in the office can be overwhelming, and the deadlines and the meetings, and to go for a coffee with someone, that's a different kind of inspiration to meet with a builder that you really connect with. Yeah. And they're, you know, they're the ones putting the sticks and bricks together. So they've got a different perspective that's really useful.
That's so true. And I'm curious, in those conversations, what are some of the questions that you're asking builders to find out if you can work with them in this early design process, if they are a good fit? Sometimes it's nice to see the work people do or look at references, but when you're just meeting for coffee, you don't always get to see the hands that are doing the work. You're trying to build that relationship. And so what is it like to have that conversation and find that resonance with someone?
Sure. For our firm and the type of work we do, I found the best builders are the ones that kind of mimic our firm in scale. It tends to be a good alignment of pace, communication, priorities. And I don't know what that necessarily says about the scale of companies, but like, so a lot of times we'll work with builders that have, you know, maybe just a handful of carpenters that work for them directly, but a stable of subcontractors that they've collaborated with on projects for 10 or 20 years. So having that sort of depth of resources to draw on that has a, you know, really strong relationship already, you know, you're going to get people that show up for projects when they're supposed to, and they're going to get paid when they're supposed to, like those things are really important. And I'd say the other thing is, you know, kind of like intuition, you know, you just kind of have to listen and flow with the conversation and feel the vibe. And if it's, I mean, maybe that sounds too like mushy, but there is something to be said about sort of listening to that inner feel of, we've interviewed with some builders that would be amazing to work with, but we walk away and think, Allison, when I say we, I mean, Allison and I, we think like they would be great to work with if we were doing their kinds of projects with their kinds of clients. And that's, you know, not necessarily a good fit, but you file them away in the back of your mind and think, okay, when that opportunity comes up, we're going to call that builder because that would be a great fit for that kind of client. And so that is, you know, that comes along, those opportunities come along and we lean into that experience or that connection. But yeah, the smaller builders, there's a vibe. I would say the ones that we love and work with over and over again have a similar approach to things, the collaborative approach. You know, they will sit down with a pencil and paper and hash through the scope and try and find ways to make things fit in a client's budget. And you get that from just having a dialogue about how they approach projects, how they approach pricing. Yeah, that's definitely the networking strength right there.
And it's amazing to be able to have that trust and to cross that bridge to avoid that traditional like headbutting that can sometimes, I don't know, I just saw it a lot in other offices and it just rubbed me wrong.
Yeah.
Were there other red flags that you might say, okay, great to meet you, but probably won't call you again?
Yeah. I mean, if someone spends too much time in our coffee date, trashing past experiences or clients, that's kind of a red flag. Or trashing architects, that's kind of a red flag. Yeah. I did have someone who spent a good chunk of time just trashing architects. And I was like, okay, I think maybe we don't need to connect again. But the ones that we stick with don't do that. I mean, it's a very much a conversational piece. And we end up, the trust that's built is really cool because we end up doing projects with them over and over and over. So like here in Charleston, we have a builder that we've worked with. I mean, the first four projects I did here, he did all of them. And two he sent to me and two I sent to him. And, you know, it was like, I started out with one, sent it to him. He you know, hit a home run on it. He's done a fabulous job. And then he sent one to me and then I sent him another. It's just been like back and forth. And then in Minneapolis, we have another builder that we've done. I mean, I took a risk on him because I didn't know him. And we did my own house and then COVID started and he did my own home renovation. And it was like, he was so lovely to work with during COVID, which is like, you know, being tested by fire. And he just like did the most amazing job for us. And it was so kind and wonderful and communicative and organized and everything through like one of the most stressful periods in building history. And I was like, we're going to send him whatever comes across our desk next. And I mean, I think he's probably done 20 projects with us, you know, and we've given work back and forth to each other a good bit, but we're not just, I point out those two because those are regular repeat collaborations, but we work with numerous builders in both Charleston and Minneapolis.
That's awesome. And it's so interesting to have a boutique firm in two locations. They seem so different. And it seems like the common factor is probably you because you grew up in South Carolina. Is that right?
That's right. Yes. Uh-huh.
And then you built this practice in this other state.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about that balance and what it was like to build a practice first in Minnesota where you did not have a long tradition of living there.
Yeah.
And then to reintegrate and reconnect with your roots back in South Carolina.
Oh, yeah. It's a great story of resilience and rebuilding. After I went to Clemson, I lived in Miami for 4 years and worked there. And then I went to Oregon for grad school, University of Oregon for grad school, and finished in 2005. And I met my late husband there. And he was from Minneapolis. And we fell in love with the Northwest and moved to Vancouver and worked in Vancouver. And we thought, well, we'll live here until the Winter Olympics in 2010. And we both were architects living there and working and just had like really cool experiences working for other architects there. And 2010 came and went and we were like, we're just going to stay. So we stayed until 2013. And at that time, I started to feel the glass ceiling for sure in Vancouver. I could tell, I was like, this is going to be really hard for me to ever start something on my own here. I just couldn't picture breaking that ceiling there. I had a great working experience, but had definitely hit a sort of plateau in my career. And at that point, we had gotten married and had two little babies. And we looked all over the United States and were like, let's move closer to family. And I sort of fell in love with Minneapolis. I wasn't quite ready to move back to Charleston, you know, after living in Miami and Vancouver, which are both, you know, very big cosmopolitan cities. I had fallen in love with the urban lifestyle and sort of the diversity of the cities. And so Minneapolis was a great fit for our next home. And his parents were there and I loved his family. And so we ended up back in Minneapolis and both of us ended up working for a while there. And then I struck out on my own in 2016. And then in 2021, he had a terrible cycling accident and passed away. And, you know, our kids were 8 and 9 years old and my family was all back in Charleston. And, you know, it was just his mom and dad there in Minneapolis at the time. So I kind of thought, well, I'm going to stay here for at least a year because, you know, I didn't want to uproot the kids and stuff, but I was feeling a pretty strong draw to be closer to my family in Charleston. My entire family's here, extended family and everything, brother, sister, aunts, everything. So the interesting thing is he and I had already talked about having some sort of presence in South Carolina. And so I had applied for an architecture license and it arrived in the mail, you know, I don't know, I think like two weeks after he died or something. It was like strangely, you know, synchronous with all of these things. And a year after that, I moved back to Charleston. And, you know, during that year, I really was like kind of starting to meet with people whenever we would come and visit Charleston and kind of just sniff around and see like, what's the temperature of the water feel like for opening a business here? And I think we had been through COVID and worked remotely on so many things because like business doubled during COVID for us. So we learned to Zoom, we learned to present, we learned to like business develop online. Like that is the craziest thing that, you know, face to face, you just can't replace, but like, well, apparently Zoom works really well to replicate that. And so my business doubled in size during COVID. And when I was contemplating moving to Charleston, you know, a year and a half later, 2 years later, I was like, well, we'll just do a lot of Zoom. And if this, or I'll fly, you know, I'll get a nanny and I'll fly back a bunch and we'll see how this works. And it has worked really well. Now, I have to say that like during that period after his death, my team just stepped in and stepped up. And in a way that like, I've always promoted autonomy among people in my office and given opportunity to like lead with, you know, with experience or get experience through leadership. And so, I mean, I had just, you know, I took time off, several months off actually, and they stepped in and kept the firm running. And that was a huge, like, I don't wish tragedy on any entrepreneur, but when you are the entrepreneur, it is really hard to let loose the reins too much. And this forced me to, I didn't care. I mean, I cared a little bit, but had to be home for my kids. And so I was like, here you go, guys, like send me a list once a week. I'll try and answer questions. And they did. And they figured it out. And like our business kept going and it still even grew a little bit that year. Like it's like a freaking miracle that it didn't shrink or lose projects or whatever. So that was a huge lesson in leaning into my team in even bigger ways than I was before and offering leadership positions to people who really stepped up. So out of that experience, Allison Landers really rose to the top in the Minneapolis office as a potential leader for the firm there. And over the past 3 years, I've been in Charleston for 3 years now. And over the past 3 years, she has grown as, you know, the business leader in Minneapolis studio. And I've grown as, you know, the leader of the entire firm to learn how to kind of facilitate that growth among everyone on the team. And it's been just like a really interesting business experience, just as a creative person and as a, you know, individual who wants to support other women growing their careers.
And it's such a journey that you've gone through. That is, my own father died when I was 13. And so I a little bit of what your children were going through, but not nearly what you're going through in terms of losing your husband and still managing this firm. But what a tribute to the culture that you first developed and the vision that you had for your firm.
Yeah.
That you had been working in these architecture firms that were top down with that hard ceiling.
Yeah.
And it's dictated down. It's that pyramid scheme of the traditional architect. And you've almost reversed that, where you are the leader, but you are uplifting everyone else to then grow beyond. Grow beyond even what you could imagine them to be able to do, but just strengthening them and building a culture that rewards and acknowledges, and that just sounds so healthy for the people on your team. And it allowed you to live your whole life and be there for your family instead of letting this business rely solely on you.
Yeah. It's hard as an architect. And I think other architects can relate to this because, you know, we go through this like really rigorous training in school that is very ego-based. Mm-hmm. And, you know, your work represents your value as a human. And so once we get out into the workforce, everyone is scrabbling for the biggest commissions and the best projects and, you know, to execute the most creative award-winning work, et cetera. And so it continues to feed that sort of ego-based culture that architecture fosters. And I think I definitely was sucked into that for part of my career. And then at a certain point, I kind of was like, well, I don't really care because, I mean, I'll do the work and do my best. But if no one's going to give me credit, then like, where's my ego in it? I don't, you know, whatever. Now, my name is on the firm. So there is like, you know, a huge amount of accountability, and I want to be proud of what we put out there. But yeah, you have to kind of, it is an exercise in not being threatened by the talent around you. And I don't think I've ever been threatened by the talent around me. I believe in hiring people who are better at certain things than I am so that they can fill the gaps that I leave in the firm. Yeah.
I like that phrase, fill in the gaps.
Fill the gaps, please. Yeah.
Inevitably there are. And that was the best firm environment I worked at. Someone, he maybe had led the firm a certain way for a long time, but when I was there, he was looking towards retirement.
Oh, yeah.
And so he was looking for these late 20s young architects who were willing to take the reins in so many different aspects of the firm.
Oh, cool.
Improving standards, improving Revit quality, improving CA, letting CA inform. And so there was just this rich culture of, hey, if you want to be a leader in this, then yeah, just show up to this or schedule these meetings and help the firm.
Isn't that great?
In this way. And it's beautiful. It was a wonderful way to grow.
Yes.
As an architect.
You learn so much.
Yes. There's so much to learn from each other. And giving people space to spread their wings and grow inside the firm.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. So what do you think are aspects of your firm that reflect your personal strengths, hopes, and dreams? I know we just talked about filling the gaps, which is letting members of your team and growing your firm so that it kind of covers your weaknesses. But what do you think when you first started Joy Architecture, how do you think it started to reflect your personal strengths, your hopes for how architectural practice and these collaborative relationships could happen, and what you dream in the future?
Sure. One of the things that I found to be, I'd say the thing that I found to be most offensive as a professional that I have made a high priority in my firm to be sort of the most accommodating is flexibility. And at the time when I encountered it, I was working for a firm in Vancouver, and I remember I had a boss who would glance at the clock every time someone walked in. And I just thought, you know, I could see the clock's right there on the column and the desk from where I sat. And I just thought like, And I was pretty senior in the firm at the time. You know, I was managing giant multifamily projects. And it would often, you know, we would have consultant meetings where I'd be the only woman at the table, and it'd be 12 people in the room discussing the, you know, next steps in this project development process. And I remember thinking like, who cares? Like, if I come in at 8:35 or 8:45 or 9 o'clock, like, who cares? if I'm getting the work done and I'm meeting the deadlines and the client's happy and the project's running, if I'm checking all the boxes, like, does that clock matter? How much does it matter? And so for me, I wanted, when I started my company, I wanted the flexibility to set my own hours, to set my own schedule. And entrepreneurs figure out really quickly, like, you're a slave to your company, like your company owns you. But if you can manage your time and manage your priorities in such a way that they, you know, it's a constant check. You have to constantly check in with yourself and be like, oh, that feels really out of control. Like, what's going on? Why is this just so out of control? Why am I so overwhelmed? Oh, well, I've like skipped all six of the potential times I could read at my kids' kindergarten class because I had, you know, an important meeting at work. And so it's like, is that how I want to spend my time? Yes, the important meeting at work is probably important, but you could probably reschedule it and you could probably go read at school and pick, you know, figure out, okay, well, do you do it once a quarter? Maybe that's what you can manage. And maybe that's what matters. Like, your kid's going to remember that you showed up and read, you know, a handful of times. They're not going to keep track or whatever. But I wanted that flexibility to decide that without someone sitting at their desk and looking at a clock on the wall. And so starting out on my own, that was a huge priority for me. If my, you know, my son was 2 and my daughter was 3.5 when I started my firm, I was like, this is crazy. Like, who does this? But it gave me the flexibility to, you know, take them to preschool in the morning and then like use the aftercare if I needed to, or pick them up at 3 if I could, you know, so it gave me that flexibility. And I know this could probably like launch into a whole other conversation about like, well, didn't her husband help out? Well, he did help out, but every family has their own dynamic and comes up with a way that works for them. So there was a trade-off of like, he worked for someone else who had a much more demanding schedule. And so my preference was that I would have the flexibility and I wanted to work for myself. And so that's what I did. I think that flexibility is hugely important. We tend to attract females who, you know, to apply to the firm, but we have men working for us as well. It's a woman-focused mentorship. So, you know, if someone is young and comes into the firm, they have to be able to accept mentorship from a woman leader. And, you know, we've got 2, now 3. I mean, we got talented women working for us. I mean, it's just like, I think that woman-focused mentorship comes from a different perspective and with a different attitude and a different approach. And that has been consistent in the firm. And I've appreciated the women mentors I had in the past and tried to emulate some of the things that they did or some of the things they didn't do. I've tried to, you know, kind of kick those out, like last minute changes. We try not to do that. What's the benefit of a last minute change? Probably it's not going to be that well thought out. Probably it's going to stress everyone out. Probably it's not going to be that well presented. So like, we'll save the last minute change for the next presentation. And it might not even be necessary. So that's the kind of thing I try not, you know, try to do or not do within the firm. I try to be really inclusive. We have people from all walks of life working for us and from all orientations. So architecture is a very white male dominated industry. And I don't know. I don't know if it's just my approach to people or the people that we attract, but we have a very, for the small firm that we are, we're very diverse in terms of nationalities and orientations and demographics. So I love that. That's how it's developed. I think it's cool.
Again, filling in those gaps.
Yeah, exactly. Filling in the gaps. Yeah. And then autonomy. I loved when I had autonomy within firms. Even one of the worst working experiences I had, I actually had a ton of autonomy. The boss didn't give me much guidance. So he would just come and yell at me if my decisions that I made were wrong. And like yell at me in front of, you know, the other 8 people in the office. So it was really awful. But I learned a ton in the 18 months that I endured that. So I try to offer the autonomy without the bullying. That's like the goal. Yeah.
You don't need to cry when you're growing.
Man, yeah. Those are some brutal years.
But you made it through. Well, I think that really solidifies which bird I think really aligns with you.
Oh, yeah.
It's hard with a firm because it almost sounds like everyone in your firm is probably a different type of architect, a different type of business person. But for you specifically, I think of a European starling. They are highly adaptable. They weren't native to America, so that reminds me of you starting your firm in Minneapolis, but they thrived when they came here, and that kind of speaks to their adaptability and their strength. And there's something else about them that reminds me of your process, and it's that they can mimic the sounds of other birds.
Oh, interesting.
And that really reminds me of how you're not dictating a design to your clients, but you're speaking their language and you're trying to work with them and help them see their vision. And so not just singing at them, but having that conversation. They're also, they look black, but their plumage is actually very colorful if you look a little deeper. So if you give them a glance, you may assume that they're one way, but they're actually, they change their color through the seasons. And they're a little more varied once you get to know them a little bit. And so that kind of speaks to some of your design aesthetics, that there's a thoughtfulness to it. It's not just surface level. You got to look into it, and there's a lot there. They also migrate. And that reminds me of your, you've got your two locations that you're working in between.
I do. I studied in Italy in undergrad and in 1998, and Clemson had a study abroad program, and we were in Rome, and over the baths, we had been touring all day, you know, like you do when you're a student, and over the baths of Caracalla at sunset, they were performing their murmurations, and it was absolutely magical. I mean, like the baths of Caracalla and giant piazza in front of us and the sun setting, and these birds are just like doing the crazy murmurations across the sky. And it lasted, I mean, I think I stood there for an hour. And, you know, my professor was probably annoyed at us because we were like, this is so mesmerizing. But it was one of the most magical moments. And it is permanently embedded in my mind's eye.
That is incredible. And what a good reminder of what happens with collaboration. When everyone on the team, when you, your coworkers who are leading the project, your contractor and your client are all working together,
it's a beautiful
thing. In this bigger
vision,
it's just transformative.
Totally.
You forget the pieces and you see the whole.
Yeah. Love it. It's great. You nailed it. The bird.
That's awesome. This is the second time a story, well, maybe the third, that a story has come out of a random bird that I've like, this is sounding right.
Oh, how cool.
This is really fun.
Nice. I'm gonna get a bird to add to my wall here.
That would be lovely. Well, cool. Joy, is there any other advice you'd like to leave young architects with as they're starting out, or advice you'd give your younger self?
Yeah. This relates to filling the gaps. So I learned really quickly when I started out on my own, I thought, I took a little room in our half story and spent, I don't know, $2,000 getting nice desk space built in so that I had a comfortable place to work. Because I knew I'd be there every free moment I had. And that was the first thing, was like, spend a little bit of time to set up your workspace, even if you're working from home, make it comfortable, professional, like you're showing up to go to work every day. So many of us start from scratch and work out of our home or a little closet space or a basement space or whatever. And that made a huge difference. And I thought, oh, I'll make two desks in here because, you know, maybe my husband will want to work at night sometimes, because that's what happens when you're, you know, in your 30s doing architecture or every decade of your life. And then 6 months, I thought, oh, I'll probably, you know, work from this little office at home for like 2 or 3 years. And then, you know, probably grow a little bit. Well, 6 months in, I needed to hire someone. And I was like, okay, I hope she didn't mind working in my home office. So the two of us were in there. And 6 months later, I met the owners of Sebastian Joe's. So like, don't be afraid to meet new people. And we just met at like a Cinco de Mayo party. And they had office space. And they're like, we're looking to lease some office space. It's only 400 square feet. And I was like, that's perfect size. So I took that leap, and very quickly I realized I needed an accountant. And so I met my accountant on nextdoor.com because she had some like leftover food from her co-op that they weren't going to eat. for like co-op bot. And I went over to her house to get some, you know, brats or something that they couldn't eat. And she's like, oh, I'm an accountant. And I was like, I need an accountant. And we talked, and she has been my accountant for almost 10 years now. And she is fabulous. So there is like zero time that an architect should spend crunching numbers unless you have a passion for accounting, because like what they can do in a fraction of the time is remarkable, and it will save you money and let you do what you're best at. So that was my first lesson in like, delegate what you're not good at. And don't be afraid to spend a little bit of money, because you'll be surprised. You can do 3 projects in the amount of time it takes you to reconcile your books on QuickBooks. Trust me, it's like torture to do QuickBooks unless you love that stuff.
We like to be generalists sometimes, but maybe we don't need to be generalists in everything. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Great advice. I love that. Joy, thank you. This has been so wonderful to talk with you about your firm and how Joy Architecture and Interior Design has grown. How can people find you?
Thank you, Katie. We're on all the things. We're on the Instagram and the Facebook and the internet. We're at joyarchitecture.com, and our handles are Joy Architecture. And we have an office in beautiful Linden Hills, Minneapolis. And we have an office in beautiful downtown Charleston, South Carolina. And our number is 612-616-9472. And go straight to my phone and I answer it still.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
To be there and be available for that. And that's the power of delegation, is that you can be there for people meeting the firm. You can be that voice for the firm because you've strengthened so many other people in those roles.
Great. Thank you so much for having me. It's been really fun to talk about. I feel inspired to tackle the rest of my week.
Joy Martin's story and architecture firm show remarkable resilience. Like the European starling thriving in a landscape far from its origins, Joy has navigated moves across the country. And since starting her architecture firm, she has been grounded in 2 different states. The starling wasn't native to North America, yet it flourished here. It learned new climates, new rhythms, new cities. That adaptability mirrors Joy's own journey, which brings us to our first point. Adaptability makes it possible to thrive in a new region, even without native roots. Many of us end up living far away from our roots. Or maybe you have moved enough that you don't feel like you have roots anywhere. Yet businesses can still be grounded in their community. One of the most effective ways is by building relationships with local contractors, discovering who aligns with your values and your project goals. The architect-contractor pairing is the backbone of a successful project. We rely on each other to get it done well. When we assemble the right team and fly together, the client receives not only a better final product, but a better project experience from start to finish, which is our second point. Collaboration is key. Starlings are known for their dazzling murmurations, thousands of individuals moving together, sensing and responding to one another to form living shapes in the sky. There's no single conductor. The beauty comes from interdependence, awareness, and trust. That same spirit defines Joy's approach to design. Her process is fluid and responsive and attuned to the rhythm of her team and her clients. She listens first, speaks in her clients' language, and lets the vision evolve through shared momentum. It isn't about directing from above, it's about co-creating from within the flock. Because Joy cultivated that culture of mutual responsiveness, she was able to step away to care for her family for a season without losing the firm she built. Her team could continue the murmur, empowered, autonomous, and capable of flying information without her constant presence. For solopreneurs, collaboration takes on different shapes. We may not have an internal team, but we can still create our own kind of murmuration. My network of other sole practitioners becomes that responsive flock. Sometimes we team up on projects, sometimes offering guidance to one another. And sometimes stepping in when a deadline or expertise requires another set of wings. Collaboration isn't limited to firm structures. It's a mindset of shared lift. There's far more nuance within the world of sole practitioners than people often recognize. And that brings us to our final point. A starling may appear simply black, but like architects in our unofficial all black uniforms, when you look closer, you'll find an iridescent shimmer of purples, blues, and greens. Their feathers reveal depth when the light hits them just right. And that's the way our work can shine. Our work carries that same hidden radiance. From the outside, the architectural process looks standardized with schematic design, design development, construction documents, bidding, permitting, construction administration. We even call it SDDDCDCA for short. And this alphabet soup seems interchangeable from one firm to another. But in practice, each architect moves through those phases in their own rhythm, their own intuition, and in their own way of achieving depth. In Joy's firm, her projects may all seem elegant and thoughtful, maybe even look the same, but beneath each clean line lies a complexity that shows a nuanced understanding of her client's needs. It's in the layered design process, and it shows sensitivity to the unseen forces that make a space feel exactly right to those exact users. Even when modern projects look so similar on the surface, the architect knows the truth. Every design is quietly tailored to the lived spatial needs of a particular client, and our clients feel this too once they inhabit the spaces. This is a reminder to honor the depth of your own work. What may look effortless to others is the result of years of craft, listening, and growth. Just like the starling's plumage, our creative brilliance often reveals itself only to those who take the time to take a closer look. So if you want to fly like Joy, like a European starling, stay adaptable, cultivate collaboration, and let your hidden brilliance shine through. Whether you're navigating new territories, or building a network of creative partners, or just uncovering the richness within your own craft, may you move forward with that same grace and synchronicity, always attuned, always adapting, and always ready to fly. Season 2 of the Flying Solo podcast is sponsored by the Minnesota Architectural Foundation, whose mission is to invest in excellence, leadership, discovery, and equity within the profession of architecture. To join the Flying Solo movement, visit the website flyingsolo.live, that's flyingsolo.live, for links to our Instagram, Substack, and the Wingbeat newsletter, a weekly dose of birdspiration and practical tips to help you grow your business and your confidence as a solopreneur architect. While you're there, take the bird quiz to discover which bird best matches your solopreneur style. For even more resources and encouragement, you can find all the Flying Solo episodes on the Gable Media platform at gablemedia.com. That's gablemedia.com, the premier destination for podcasts about architecture and design. And if you're looking for community, connection, and real conversations, check out the Entree Architect Network at entrearchitect.com. There's a link in the show notes. Whether you join one of their masterclasses or the free Facebook group, you'll find a community of small firm architects sharing ideas, challenges, and wins, proving that while we may work solo, we're never alone. As Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, says, it's all about doing better practice and better work every day. Thank you for listening to Flying Solo. I'm Katie Kangas, and my hope is to empower you, aspiring architects and creative entrepreneurs, to soar to new heights and embrace the freedom of flying solo.